crawled off the litter and directed the bearers to give their first attention to the other man. Awaiting the litter bearer's return, he was again struck, this time suffering a compound fracture of one arm. With magnificent fortitude, he bound a rifle stock to his shattered arm as a splint and then crawled 300 yards over rough terrain to the aid station. Through his outstanding bravery and unflinching determination in the face of desperately dangerous conditions, Private Doss saved the lives of many soldiers. His name became a symbol throughout the 77th Infantry Division for outstanding gallantry far above and beyond the call of duty. Though the events described in the citation are, of course, true, they were based on the hasty recollections of men immediately following the actions described, and their sequence is not in exact order. "I'm proud of you," the president said. "You really deserve this. I consider this a greater honor than being president." Then he hung the medal, the nation's highest honor, around Desmond's neck. After that, General Marshall came down the line and congratulated the medal winners. This was another thrill. Desmond had carried that document signed by Marshall stipulating he would not be forced to bear arms all during the war. The War Department had put out a full press release on Desmond's being awarded the medal. His escort obtained several copies of it, and Desmond and Dorothy and their parents read it together. "A conscientious objector who was assigned to the Medical Corps, United States Army, Private First Class Desmond T. Doss of Lynchburg, Virginia, displayed such outstanding bravery and unflinching determination in aiding his wounded comrades in the fierce Okinawa campaign that he has been awarded the Medal of Honor," it was announced today by the War Department. The nation's highest decoration goes to the 26-year-old soldier who, although not bearing arms, performed so many feats of heroism on the battlefields of Guam, Leyte, and Okinawa that his name became a symbol for outstanding gallantry throughout the 77th Infantry Statue of Liberty Division. Private Doss's wife, Dorothy Pauline, lives at Route 9, Box 66, Richmond, Virginia, and his parents, Mr. and Mrs. William T. Doss, reside at 1835 Easley Avenue, Lynchburg. The medal will be presented to Private Doss by President Truman at the White House on Friday, October 12th. Private Doss, a member of the 307th Infantry Medical Detachment, 1st Battalion, received the unstinting praise of fighting men of the 77th Division from generals to privates. Brigadier General Edwin H. Randall, commanding general of the division, asserted, "This soldier, by his unfailing devotion to duty and his gallantry and intrepidity at the risk of his life above and beyond the call of duty, has gained the respect, admiration, and affection of the entire division." This is more noteworthy as, on being inducted into the military service, Private Doss was, and still is, a conscientious objector. He refused to carry arms or even touch a weapon. His organization commander transferred him to the Battalion Medical Detachment, where he was made company aide man because he wanted to be forward with the men. In the Guam and Leyte campaigns, Private Doss demonstrated the same qualities. No matter how heavy the fire, he remained and cared for wounded men regardless of consequences or danger. Private Doss was awarded the Medal of Honor for specific acts of supreme heroism on Okinawa in the Ryukyu Islands between April 29 and May 21, 1945. 1st Lieutenant Onless C. Brister, 245 Central Avenue, Winona, Mississippi, pointed out, "Private Doss was at all times up with the front lines to care for injured men. In several instances, he braved intense enemy small arms and mortar fire to give aid and to move men who were wounded." 1st Lieutenant Cecil L. Gornto of Live Oak, Florida, was 1st Platoon Leader of Company B, to which Private Doss was attached from April 29 to May 8th. "On the morning of April 29, Lieutenant Gornto related, heavy mortar fire was falling in the area, and someone called for a medic. Private Doss left his hole and climbed to the top of the hill. He found the wounded man in total darkness and gave him first aid. As soon as it was light enough, I observed him lowering the wounded man over the cliff on a rope to evacuate him. This man had both legs blown off." Another link in the Doss chain of sterling heroism was told by 2nd Lieutenant Kenneth L. Phillips, Route 3, Lexington, North Carolina. "On May 5, during an intense grenade battle in the vicinity of Kankazoo," Lieutenant Phillips said, "four men were badly wounded while trying to blow up a cave. They were lying under a vicious hail of grenade and mortar fire. With total disregard for his own personal safety, Private Doss went forth four times and pulled the wounded men to safety." Private First Class Carl B. Bentley of Fulshear, Texas, spoke of an instance on May 2nd.
Private Doss was told of a man out in the front lines between our line and the Japs. He went out and brought this man in under very heavy rifle and knee-mortar fire.
The climax in the Virginian's amazing battle career as a male angel of mercy occurred on the night of May 21st, when he was badly injured, thereby winning an oak leaf cluster to the Purple Heart he earned May 10, when he was less seriously wounded. Technician 5th grade Ralph E. Baker, one of the 1st Battalion medics, tells the story. On May 21st, Private Doss was wounded by an enemy grenade. Instead of calling another aid man from the safety of his foxhole, Private Doss treated his own wounds and gave himself a shot of morphine when the pain became too great. Litter bearers reached him in the morning, almost 6 hours later. After they carried him about 50 yards, the litter bearers were halted momentarily by bursts of mortar fire. Private Doss crawled off the litter and told the aid men to take more seriously wounded men in first. He was wounded a second time while he lay there. He bound a rifle stock to his shattered arm to form a splint and crawled to the aid station despite his wounds. Private Doss, who was born February 7, 1919, in Lynchburg, entered the Army at Camp Lee, Virginia, on April 1, 1942. He was a ship joiner before his induction. He was awarded the Bronze Star for his meritorious service as a medical aid man on Leyte in the Philippine Islands from December 7th to 21st, 1944. Again, there are small discrepancies. To top it all, Desmond was given a 10-day furlough. He and Dorothy went to her home in Richmond. For weeks he had been trying to get transferred to the McGuire General Hospital there. He was now able to get around fairly well. His leg was almost as good as new, except for a few small fragments of metal which remained in it, and occasionally caused pain. The bones in his shattered arm had knit, the bullet had been removed, and the incision was healing well. Desmond had been told that he would not be able to use the arm again, but he believed that with God's help and his own continued effort and exercise, he would develop strength and mobility in it. In the near future, he would receive his honorable discharge. He had not yet decided whether he would arrange to be discharged out of the special provisions granted a winner of the Congressional Medal of Honor, as a disabled veteran, or on the basis of the large number of discharge points he had earned overseas and in combat. Pending his separation from the service, it would be a great convenience if he could be stationed at McGuire, to be near Dorothy. One day he dropped into the hospital to ask if he could in any way expedite the transfer from Woodrow Wilson. Papers throughout the country, indeed all over the world, had carried the story of the conscientious objector who had won the Congressional Medal of Honor. In Richmond, because of Dorothy's connection with the city, the papers had devoted large spreads to the hero medic. When he entered the administration building, he was recognized immediately and escorted into the office of the commanding officer.
"You don't need to have a transfer," Desmond was told. "You don't even have to go back to Woodrow Wilson. We'll send word back there you weren't feeling well and checked in with us while you were here on furlough."
"Oh, no," Desmond said, unused to cutting corners in the military. "I'll go back there and check out personally." In the meantime, Desmond had to make another appearance. His hometown, Lynchburg, was clamoring for him to come back for a hero's welcome. Plans were quickly made. He was met at the station by city officials and driven down Main Street in an open car in a full military parade. Bands played, and banners proclaimed him the Wonder Man of Okinawa. Post 16 of the American Legion gave him a life membership. Late in October, Desmond returned to Woodrow Wilson to make his transfer. Colonel Connor met him with a big salute. When Desmond looked embarrassed, the colonel said,
"Remember, soldier, the Medal of Honor rates the salute of a 5-star general."
This is a common misconception. Many high officers salute Medal of Honor winners, but it is a matter of individual choice, not a requirement. Regulations did, in 1945, provide that a Medal of Honor man may travel in a military aircraft when space is available, that his son may get special assistance with an appointment to West Point or Annapolis, that he would receive $2 per month and a pension of $120 a year at the age of 65. And so Desmond returned to McGuire in Richmond. He had a Class A pass, which meant that he could come and go as he liked. He had long been thinking about what he would like to do when he got out of the service. Though some strength was beginning to come back to his left arm, he knew he would not be able to go back to his old trade of carpentry, or, indeed, any craft which required two good arms. He was exploring, however, two interesting avenues of financial fulfillment. While at Swannanoa Hospital, he had spent a weekend at the home of a friend who was a florist. The friend had had to make a few wreaths, and Desmond had helped. He was pleased with the wreath he had made. He thought it as good as that made by the professionals. Desmond had always loved flowers. As a child, then as a youth, he had cultivated flowers and flowering shrubs. Now there was much talk of the GI Bill of Rights, which would help veterans in their adjustment to peace. Perhaps, Desmond thought, the new legislation would in some way make it possible for him to learn more about flowers and the florist business, and perhaps even have his own florist shop. The other avenue was also concerned with living, beautiful organisms, though somewhat different from flowers. In Richmond one day, he passed a small shop featuring tropical fish, and he became interested in them. The proprietor appreciated his interest and whetted it. A man could earn a comfortable and pleasant living raising and selling exotic fish, he said. Surely now Desmond would, in the words of the 91st Psalm, abide under the shadow of the Almighty. His army pay and allotment continued. He wore the nation's highest decoration. At long last, he and Dorothy could begin to raise that family of which they had dreamed so many years. They were young and brave and positive that they could provide for those children in a Christian home. If it were possible to make Desmond's faith in God any stronger, to increase his desire to serve the Lord and his fellow man, and to spread the gospel, then his ordeal in the South Pacific had done just that. Too many times he had crossed areas exposed to small arms, mortar, even artillery fire on an errand of mercy without being scratched, not to believe that the Lord was protecting him. He had been wounded, yes, and seriously so, but he was alive and home and healthy, and he was thankful. He further resolved that, as a tribute and in gratitude to the glory of God, he would go anywhere the church asked him, speak to whatever group wanted to hear him, and in any and every way advance the work of the Lord and the church. Chapter 8. Peace and Adversity. It would be wonderful to leave Desmond and Dorothy at that moment in time, where they were at the zenith of their happiness, together, looking ahead to the future they had dreamed of through 4 difficult years. Indeed, many friends, acquaintances, and fellow members of the Seventh-day Adventist Church over the world have taken it for granted that Desmond and Dorothy have led a contented and uneventful life since the war. Unfortunately, they have met with some adversities. Just before Desmond planned to be separated from the army, he was examined for what he thought must be a touch of pleurisy. The diagnosis? Tuberculosis. The sound of the dread word numbed him. Later, in discussing his previous medical history with the doctors, he recalled that period on Leyte when he had chills and fever and was so weak he could not keep up with the company. That had been the beginning of it. Then came the Maida Escarpment, with its hot days, cold, wet nights, lack of sleep, exhaustion, and long periods without proper food. Even then, it could have been worse. The disease was restricted to one lung. The doctors hoped it could be cleared up easily. Instead of being discharged and settling down to live happily ever after with Dorothy, Desmond was shipped 2,000 miles away from her, to Fitzsimons General Hospital in Denver, Colorado.
"It's the best," the doctors told him, "and you deserve the best."
Lonely, almost forgotten, depressed, Desmond sank lower and lower. He worried about Dorothy, now pregnant with the child they had waited for so long. The doctors felt that he would make a quicker recovery if there were no stimulation whatsoever, not even that of his beloved wife, and they remained apart, miserably apart. These two people did not belong apart. Finally, Desmond convinced the doctors that his progress could not possibly be slower, and Dorothy was permitted to come to him. She lived with an Adventist family in Denver and visited Desmond every day. He began improving immediately. When he seemed much better, Desmond was discharged from the Army and transferred, as a veteran with full benefits, to McGuire Hospital in Richmond, now a veterans facility. It was an unfortunate move. The hospital administration, adjusting to civilian-military control, permitted some laxness. One tragic example was unlimited smoking. Even patients in advanced stages of tuberculosis smoked like chimneys. Desmond saw men smoke themselves to death, and sometimes the smoke around him was so thick that he was afraid he would join them. Nothing could be worse than that environment, and Desmond talked the powers that be into permitting him to leave the hospital as an outpatient. He and Dorothy went home to Lynchburg. He had a weekly treatment in which air was injected into his left pleural cavity to collapse the lung and permit it to rest. Desmond himself was under orders to rest during a large part of every day. He had been warned not to do any work requiring physical exertion. But now Desmond had not only himself and Dorothy to feed, but also Desmond Thomas Doss Jr., born September 15, 1946. The baby was not permitted to come near his father lest he be infected. Desmond's total pension for 100% disability was $118 a month. Dorothy worked in a hosiery mill from 3 to 11 p.m. The American Legion in Lynchburg had helped him get a priority for a new car so he could get to the doctor for the pneumothorax treatment, and Desmond had been too appreciative of their efforts to say he couldn't afford it. So he had payments to keep up. His friend in a Richmond fish shop sold him a complete setup for raising tropical fish at cost, along with breeding stock of such exotics as black mollies, angelfish, swordtails, guppies, and snails. It was a good deal, in an enterprise which can be highly profitable. He bought books and plunged into the operation on a large scale. Desmond is incapable of doing anything in a small way. One day, checking the thermometer, he noticed that the reading was too low. He quickly began raising the temperature of the water to the required point. Still, the mercury in the thermometer did not rise. Not until after he had lost every single fish did he discover that the fault lay in the thermometer. He was out of the fish business completely. He had started too big. He had nothing left with which to begin again. He had already been doing too much, working with the fish and about the yard. Now, in a desperate effort to get some money in, he began selling door-to-door in the neighborhood. Activity, pressure, anxiety. At one of his checkups, the doctor examined him through a fluoroscope. After a long pause, he said,
"Desmond, I can't treat you here anymore."
Now he had tuberculosis in both lungs. This time it was the VA's Otine Hospital near Asheville, North Carolina. His condition steadily worsened. Finally, Dorothy and little Tommy moved to Asheville to be near him. From then on, his condition improved. The doctors had now decided that the left lung must be removed. However, before removing it, they had to build it up so that it could take some of the load off the right lung, thus permitting the right lung to heal. The left lung, however, was in such bad shape that the bronchial tubes had a tendency to collapse. They had to be dilated. This was done every 2 weeks physically in a modern scientific torture called bronchoscopy. In the bronchoscopy, a chrome pipe the size of a man's thumb is pushed down the throat so that forceps can be inserted to dilate the tubes. It is extremely painful. After every treatment, Desmond would spit blood for days. It tore him up. He couldn't eat. And he had more than 30 bronchoscopies over a period of a little more than a year. In early 1950, he received his reward. Two operations. In the first stage, the left lung plus 1.5 ribs on the left side were removed. A month later, 4.5 more ribs were removed. A year later, he had recovered to the point that he could be sent to Swannanoa for rehabilitation. Dorothy, of course, and little Tommy came along too, living in a furnished room in town. The only work that permitted her both to take care of Tommy and visit Desmond was part-time house cleaning. Desmond was released from Swannanoa in October 1951. Since being wounded more than 6 years before, he had spent only a few months out of a hospital. His only income had been the monthly check, now $138, he received from his grateful government, and the few dollars Dorothy made in domestic work. Desmond looked for some kind of work in Richmond, but no one wanted a Medal of Honor winner with a shot-up leg, a withered arm, and only one lung. He went on to Lynchburg. There he arranged for on-the-job training as a cabinet maker, for which he would be paid out of the GI Bill of Rights. Desmond gradually came to realize that his physical condition would not let him work all day every working day, yet it was required of him. He lived in constant fear that if he did not work, he would lose his income, and that if he did work, he would suffer a relapse and have to go back to the hospital. They were renting an old farmhouse outside of Lynchburg for $50 a month. It was impossible to heat, and so shabby that Desmond offered to paint it if the landlord would furnish the paint. The landlord agreed, and Desmond found that the paint was mostly used motor oil. In addition to little Tommy, now 5 years old, Dorothy took care of her sister's two children. That summer of 1952, the program committees of Adventist camp meetings in several parts of the country asked Desmond to come and tell of his experiences in which he won the nation's highest award. Desmond had never refused a speaking engagement provided he was out of the hospital or could get out. It was his unilateral agreement with God. Though he felt inadequate as a public speaker, he learned to overcome his nervousness. Because it was easier to show people than to tell them, he carried with him a length of rope and demonstrated the double bowline with which he lowered the wounded from the escarpment. He showed the Bible and the Medal of Honor. His presentation became effective, even appealing. He was, after all, one of the nation's great heroes, and the only conscientious objector to win the Congressional Medal of Honor. If he had just stood up there without speaking, he would have been an attraction. His homely, hesitant little speech, his demonstration with the rope, and, finally, his unashamed and unassuming faith in his Creator have surely combined to encourage thousands of people to reaffirm their own belief in the God of Desmond Doss. Later that year, Dorothy collapsed. She had held herself together for 9 years of married life, a year of living in the catch-as-catch-can housing around Army camps, 2 years while the man she loved served in the bloody South Pacific, and now 6 years of strain and hardship. No one could blame Dorothy Doss for breaking down. After some months of sporadic and unsatisfactory treatment, Desmond took Dorothy to the little Seventh-day Adventist sanitarium near Wildwood, Georgia. Here, at last, with patience, love, faith, understanding, and prayer, Dorothy began to recover. Desmond was caring for Tommy as best he could, and working in a maintenance capacity for a small, poor institution for young children on top of rugged, rocky Lookout Mountain, just a few miles from Wildwood. It was a comfortless, penny-pinching existence. He managed to acquire a small 4-acre tract of land with a trailer on it for $50 an acre, and, in his spare time, put together a small frame house of the materials bought at bargains here and there. The money came from cashing in his government life insurance. In 1957, Desmond was asked to fly to Hollywood, California, all expenses paid, to discuss a possible movie. When he arrived, he was whisked to a studio and then suddenly out on a stage in front of an audience of several hundred people. He was on the television program, This Is Your Life. For the next half hour, he saw his life in review. Colonel Cooney had flown in from Florida to say how he had seriously considered sending Private Doss back from Hawaii because he wouldn't carry a gun. Officers and men of B Company told how Desmond had saved their lives and how his actions that day on the escarpment were the most heroic thing they had ever seen. Dorothy and Tommy were there too, and his mother and father. At the end of the show, Ralph Edwards, the master of ceremonies, presented him with a power saw, a power shop, movie camera, money enough to increase his little holding on Lookout Mountain to 7 acres, a cow, tractor with attachments, and a station wagon. That marked the beginning of the upturn in the life of Desmond, Dorothy, and Tommy Doss. Desmond has been able to make his house solid and comfortable. He grows the vegetables and fruits he likes. There's a small lake with a boat, ducks, and fish. His disability payments have increased, and in 1965, Congress passed a law paying Medal of Honor winners $100 extra a month. Dorothy went back to school and got her nursing degree. However, in 1966, she began the intensely satisfying work of teaching in the Head Start program. And little Tommy is little Tommy no longer. At the age of 20, he was inducted into the armed services. Like his father before him, but with none of the confusion, he was placed in the medical department where he belonged and where he wanted to be. However, also like his father before, Tommy fell in love and got married. He and his wife decided it would be more practical for him to accept the special discharge available to only sons of deceased or war-disabled veterans. For many years of Tommy's life, Desmond could not be the father he wanted to be. A memory that haunts him still is of his baby crawling to the threshold of his room in the little house in Lynchburg and stopping there. It was a household rule that the baby could not enter his tubercular father's room. and that the father could not come near his son. Then there were the many years in which Desmond or Dorothy was in a hospital. Unable to help his own child, Desmond in recent years has found a way to help others. With his own money and labor, and that of others in the community, he set out to enlarge the little church on Lookout Mountain to include a school for the children of the mountain. It is a poor region, with played-out coal mines and small, scrubby farms. Money does not come easily. But under the inspirational, hard-working leadership of Desmond Doss, who has done far more than he has asked anyone else to do, people have contributed both their goods and their energies. One church member, convalescing from a long illness and unable to work, sold his own home in order to make a contribution. The Lookout Mountain Seventh-day Adventist Church and School is the greatest undertaking of my life, Desmond said. As the recipient of a monthly stipend from the government, Desmond has sought to serve his country and his people as best he could in return. When the Civilian Defense Rescue Service was formed in Walker County, Georgia, Desmond was the leader in his area. He helped buy an old truck, and he put in long hours and considerable money helping to fix it up and equip it. In April 1966, his squad was put to the test. 8 Boy Scouts and 3 adult leaders became lost in a cave. Working around the clock in the dark, wet, gas-filled cavern, Desmond and his co-workers saved 7 of the scouts and 1 of the leaders. After it was all over, the other rescue workers revealed that Desmond spent more consecutive hours in the cave working harder than anyone else. And it was the Sabbath, too. Chapter 9. The Heritage of Desmond Doss. 20 years after Desmond Doss was awarded the Medal of Honor, another patriotic young American went out to serve his country on the battlefield. His name was Curtis A. Reed of Gillette, Wyoming. Like Desmond, he was a Seventh-day Adventist. Like Desmond, he was willing and eager to serve his country. Unlike Desmond, who joined a newly reactivated division, Reed became part of the famous 1st Division, the Big Red One. The division was already in service in the Republic of Vietnam when Curtis Reed joined it. The other men in the headquarters company, 1st Battalion, 26th Infantry, saw that he had no gun, and they quickly learned that he was a Sabbath keeper. But how different was his reception from that of Desmond Doss 20 years before?
Boy,
one of the veterans of the Vietnam campaign said with admiration,
I'd never have the nerve to go out on one of these missions without a gun.
You medics have got a lot more guts than I have, said another rifleman.
From the beginning, a warm feeling of camaraderie developed between Reed and the men whose lives he someday might save. That day came, March 24, 1966, in the jungles north of Phu Loi. Reed's company was advancing slowly through the dense underbrush of a fortified area when grenades began bursting all around them and bullets whistled through the thicket. The Americans hit the ground and lay still, all except Curtis Reed. Wounded men were calling out. He moved forward in the direction of both his wounded men and the Viet Cong. The first casualty was a good friend, a sergeant, hit in the shoulder. Reed cut away the upper part of the man's jacket and applied a battle dressing. The sergeant kept telling him to go attend to the other men, but Reed insisted on first staunching the flow of blood. He crawled on farther, past a dead soldier who had been shot in the head, to another sergeant who had been badly hit. The soldier died while Reed was working on him. Meanwhile, another medic came up and began treating another wounded American. He rose up on his knees, and instantly 5 shots rang out. He was hit 3 times in the chest, 2 in the leg. The unseen Viet Cong were so close Reed smelled the acrid gunpowder. Reed did what he could for his fellow medic, but the wounds were fatal. The next man had been hit 2, in the head and in the leg. Reed treated him and continued. He was wet with blood and sweat. The heat was intense, and the humidity in the breathless jungle was extremely enervating. But Reed kept moving, crawling to his buddies and treating them. Finally, tanks came up to cover the company's retreat. Curtis Reed was the last man to leave the bloody area. For his heroism in that operation, the young Adventist was awarded the Bronze Star and later the Oak Leaf Cluster for distinguishing himself by outstanding meritorious service in connection with ground operations against a hostile force. Through his untiring efforts and professional ability, he consistently obtained outstanding results, the citation continued. He was quick to grasp the implications of new problems with which he was faced as a result of the ever-changing situation inherent in a counterinsurgency operation and to find ways and means to solve those problems. The energetic application of his extensive knowledge materially contributed to the effort of the U.S. mission to the Republic of Vietnam to assist that country in ridding itself of the communist threat to its freedom. His initiative, zeal, sound judgment, and devotion to duty have been in the highest tradition of the United States Army and reflect great credit on him and on the military service. It is interesting to note that in that citation, there is no mention of the fact that Reed was a conscientious objector or Seventh-day Adventist. He was simply an American soldier doing his job in a distinguished, outstanding manner. Many of the more than 7,000 Adventist soldiers in the Army today report that they are accepted as they are and for what they are, without any critical comment. The individual actions of these brave men have done much to make them welcome in the military establishment. However, there is no question but that having a Congressional Medal of Honor winner in their numbers has made military service easier for the thousands of young Adventists who have proved their willingness and eagerness to serve their country in uniform. There is a great reverence among military men for the nation's highest award, the Congressional Medal of Honor. Those men who have won it have organized their own group, which meets in convention with respectful cooperation from the armed services in the host city once a year. Desmond has attended every convention his health has permitted. He enjoys the respect of his fellow heroes. On the 100th anniversary of the creation of the medal in 1962, it was Desmond who was selected by his fellow medal winners of World War II to represent them at the White House. He and President Kennedy had a pleasant chat. As the only conscientious objector to win the medal, he is always sought out by local press, radio, and television at convention cities for special interviews and appearances. He is frequently sought for television shows. Millions of people, especially those who have come of age during the generation following World War II, have learned about the Seventh-day Adventist Church and its patriotic policy of cooperation with its government through its war hero, Desmond Doss. During the Korean War, the War Services Commission of the Seventh-day Adventist Church decided to establish a permanent national training camp for future medical soldiers. Carlisle B. Haynes, chairman of the commission, the one who had done so much to help Desmond during his early service in World War II, and Everett N. Dick, who founded the Medical Cadet Corps and commanded it for a quarter of a century, agreed that the camp should have no other name but Camp Desmond T. Doss. Its first session at the permanent home at Grand Ledge, Michigan, was held in June 1951. Desmond was convalescing at Swannanoa, but he still managed to get a furlough for the entire 2 weeks duration of the camp. Trim and military in summer uniform, he was active in every phase of the camp's activities, but his greatest contribution was in just being there. He walked around and visited with the cadets. He was their idol. They loved to talk with him. For the demonstrations which concluded the camp, Desmond not only stood on the reviewing stand, he helped build it. The Sabbath services were conducted by Elder Haynes. Midway through his sermon, the old gentleman suffered a fainting spell. Desmond took over immediately. Within less than a minute, a litter was on hand. With Desmond at one post, the unconscious man was carried off to a shady spot. "Loosen his collar," Desmond directed. "Raise his feet." Soon, Elder Haynes was back on his feet again, as good as new. And Desmond Doss, having plied both his civilian trade of carpenter and his Army's specialty as first aid man, in addition to having inspired his company of cadets for 2 weeks, went on back to Swannanoa Hospital to continue his convalescence from the removal of a lung and 5 ribs. At Fort Sam Houston, Texas, where most Adventists are sent for training in the medical department, the rookies are high in their praise of the Medical Cadet Corps training in general, and of the intensive 2-week course put on at Camp Desmond T. Doss in particular. In these courses, the cadet is taught not only how to serve as a conscientious cooperator, but the full philosophical meaning of why. "The things I learned in the MCC about why we're non-combatants and why we keep the Sabbath have been a real help to me in my Army service," said one young man on completing his basic training. "It gave me a head start," said another. "By the time I got to Fort Sam Houston, I was already in the know on some military matters." And another, "Sure, Camp Doss was sort of rough, but it wasn't anything compared with the real thing a little later when Uncle Sam called. I appreciated the training and preparation I got in the MCC." since its inception in January of 1934, the MCC has trained approximately 30,000 men in North America and another 12,000 in various overseas divisions. More than 1,000 take MCC training in the United States each year. Similar programs were being conducted in 1967 in South Korea, the Philippines, South Vietnam, Malaysia, Brazil, and Trinidad. Through the spring of 1967, four young Adventists, including Curtis Reed, had won the Bronze Star for Valor as medical aid men. Specialist 4th Class Melvin E. Coltfarber from Battleground, Washington, was on a patrol with his unit near Bao Cap when a large force of Viet Cong attacked with automatic and small arms weapons and mortars. Many Americans were wounded. Coltfarber, moving from man to man, received a serious wound in his leg from an exploding mortar shell. Bleeding badly and in great pain, he treated his wounds as quickly as he could, then continued to take care of his wounded comrades. He refused to be evacuated until other medics came up to carry on his work. Another hero, PFC Fred Villanueva, serving in Vietnam with the 4th Cavalry Regiment, was on patrol with a group of armored vehicles when they ran into a withering hail of grenade and automatic weapons fire. There were several casualties. Villanueva, deliberately leaving the comparative safety of his armored vehicle, went from one to another, braving the swarm of bullets that followed him to attend to the wounded men. He was climbing aboard one tank to reach the wounded men inside when one of the enemy threw a hand grenade at him. Several fragments struck him and knocked him off the tank. He got up, climbed back on, and took care of the wounded man. He continued on, treating every other wounded man in the unit before he stopped to care for his own wounds. The fourth Seventh-day Adventist hero in Vietnam shared some of that ostracism which Desmond Doss had first suffered. When George M. Mike Vartenyuk of Suffield, Ohio, joined the 5th Mechanized Unit of the 25th Infantry Division, he found that he was the first conscientious objector to serve with the unit.
"Where's your rifle?"
the platoon sergeant demanded.
"Don't you know there's a war on?"
Mike didn't argue. He knew that before long he would be given an opportunity to prove that even the unarmed could serve. That opportunity arrived just 3 days later. He treated a wounded soldier and brought him back through a hail of enemy bullets. A few days after that, the sergeant himself stopped a bullet in the leg. Mike went out to him, put a dressing on the wound, and carried the sergeant to safety. Then the 25th Division was assigned the job of cleaning out the infamous Iron Triangle, a jungle area north of Saigon. Mike's company, composed of armored personnel carriers, was hit by a Viet Cong ambush. The VCs were throwing everything they had. An enemy shell blew the track off the lead vehicle, and the entire column came to a halt. Another shell landed in the vehicle behind Mike Vartenyuk. A case of mortar fuses started burning. 7 men were trapped inside the vehicle, along with some 60 mortar shells. Mike ran to the blazing vehicle. He pulled out 2 men who were blocking the exit. He went into the hot, smoky interior again and again until every man was safe. Just as Desmond Doss maintained that he did not save as many men as the officers said, so Mike insists that, contrary to the reports, he did not go into the blazing vehicle 7 separate times. "I think some of the men got out by themselves," he said. In addition to pulling whatever number out of the vehicle, he also pulled them away from it before it exploded. And though bullets were buzzing through the air, Mike gave blood plasma to 4 of the men, standing up, holding the bottle high so that the plasma would run down into their veins. After that, there was no more ostracism for Mike Vartenyuk. Men sought him out, asked him to tell them about his religion, and when the tough sergeant who had criticized the unarmed medic that first day left Vietnam, he made a special effort to say goodbye to Mike Vartenyuk.
"I want you to come visit me when you get home," the sergeant said. "You're welcome there any time."
There will probably always be men like Doss and Vartenyuk, misunderstood Christians who must prove themselves and their motives to their fellow soldiers. But because of their very actions, their complete acceptance has become and will continue to be, in Army language, more and more SOP, Standing Operating Procedure, or Standard Operating Procedure. The influence and inspiration of Desmond Doss extends into groups other than the military and even beyond the shores of his country. His exploits have been told the world over. No one can guess how many persons have been, and will be in years to come, introduced to Adventism and encouraged to join the movement, directly or indirectly, through his faith and heroism. When Desmond first saw Okinawa, for example, There was not one Seventh-day Adventist on that faraway little island. After the war, a mission was established, and soon a school and medical center were thriving there. Okinawan church members erected two markers, one with English wording, one with Japanese, commemorating Desmond's exploits. The little Okinawan church has even had its own small miracle, the miracle of the papaya trees. An older woman who first bitterly opposed the church became converted and gave two of her 10 papaya trees to the church. The other 8 bore only a few small fruit, but the 2 trees which belonged to the Lord delivered 140 papayas in all, each weighing 4 to 5 pounds. On Okinawa, as on Guam and Leyte, Desmond felt that caring for his buddies, he was under the shadow of the Almighty. But even if he was killed, he believed his death would be in a good cause if it occurred while he was caring for his fellow man, as Jesus Christ had done. Desmond Doss did not die, but lived to receive one of the highest temporal honors. Though they have suffered adversities, he and Dorothy have lived to see positive and increasing results of his heroism and sacrifice. He has continued to serve God and man. In conflict, he found encouragement in the 91st and 93rd Psalms. In his peaceful life on Lookout Mountain, his faith and his actions continue to be steadfast. They repeat what the psalmist said.
Thy testimonies are very sure. Holiness becometh thine house, O Lord, forever.
Epilogue by Les Speer. I had recently returned from teaching in a college in Africa where we had to face terrorism on a daily basis. Sitting on Desmond's front porch, I told of torture, rape, and killing in the community where we lived. Radio Maputo had announced that our Salusi College faculty would be killed and the students liberated. Our faculty was mostly white, and all students were African of many different nationalities. We understood that this broadcast meant that our young men would be forced to be freedom fighters, terrorists, or be killed, and the young ladies would be expected to satisfy the young men's sexual desires. I told Desmond of my struggle with the decision to purchase a local version of the Israeli Uzi to defend my family and my students. Desmond listened quietly for quite a while, then remarked, "In a different kind of war, I might have made a different decision." I found that response very insightful and rather broad-minded. After Desmond's enlistment, in the early years of the war, he was branded a pacifist. Desmond resented the label, repeatedly explaining that he was a conscientious cooperator. The brand never gained traction. He wanted to serve his country. He wanted to care for the men who were fighting for American principles and freedoms. His fellow soldiers came to respect, admire, and champion Desmond as an exemplary American patriot. Desmond understood his status of hero in the eyes of others, but he was uncomfortable with the accolade and always identified the real heroes as the men he served with, especially those who lost their lives. Up to his death, this humble, selfless man of great faith credited God with his courage, bravery, valor under fire, and his survival. When Desmond returned from the war, and after his 5.5 years of recovery in hospitals and special therapy, he received mixed responses from the typical American. Some Americans did not appreciate Desmond's non-combat status during the war, but most people were happy to honor a war hero. Through the years, Desmond's picture was on the front pages of many city newspapers from coast to coast, in Memorial Day parades, or speaking to school assemblies, public and parochial, faith communities of varied denominations, and young fraternal organizations such as Boy Scouts. When he went to the annual Medal of Honor Society conventions, it was very common for the other recipients of the Congressional Medal of Honor to get in line to talk to their hero, Desmond Doss. When group pictures were taken, Desmond's fellow Medal of Honor recipients often asked Desmond to stand in the front row. It was common for a simple trip to the grocery store to turn into a long visit with a passerby who noticed Desmond's Medal of Honor license plate. He never seemed distressed when a crowd sometimes wanted to spend 20 or 30 minutes visiting with him. A quiet, humble man. One soldier told me that Desmond was one of the greatest heroes of our nation, yet Desmond treated this private as if he was the hero.
Desmond Doss Sr. loved America more than anyone I have ever met. To go into his living room was to be greeted by 25 or 30 American flags. One flag had flown over the nation's Capitol building, and one over the Georgia Capitol building. Instead of a group of flowers, there was a bouquet of flags in a large cluster. In 1976, Desmond became totally deaf, presumably from the massive doses of streptomycin used to treat the tuberculosis contracted during the war. Desmond's wife, Dorothy, a registered nurse, became his ears. During conversations with friends or in church, she wrote out thousands of pages of conversation so Desmond could know what was being said. A new medical treatment, cochlear implant, became available in 1988. A number of small miracles combined to allow Desmond to be able to get this new surgery at Loma Linda University Hospital in California free of charge. Transportation, travel expenses, housing, and an apartment to live in were provided by the Veterans Administration, Chattanooga military groups, and Dorothy's family members. The recovery took months, but Desmond could hear again after 12 years. Now Desmond's struggle was to interpret the Donald Duck sounds from his implant into meaningful conversation. Most people talked too fast and high-pitched for Desmond to understand. If a person would lower his or her voice in pitch, slow the speed, and face Desmond so he could lip-read, it was possible to carry on a meaningful conversation. In 1991, Desmond's wife, Dorothy, was diagnosed with cancer. She was a BSRN and knew the struggle ahead. Within a year, both Desmond and Dorothy's mothers had died from cancer. Dorothy believed that if she put off surgery as long as possible, it would give her the best quality of life. She had hospital treatment, but was not operated on. I think it was November 17th when Dorothy decided it was time to go to the hospital, with the likelihood that she would have surgery. Dorothy was a very strong person, and only severe pain would move her to make this decision. It was a rainy morning, as I remember. Desmond drove toward town. He was not going fast. At one point, he applied the brakes on a curve. The car's tires may have hydroplaned, and perhaps the wheel got off the pavement. He lost control, and the car went over the embankment and a telephone pole hit Dorothy's side of the car, and she died. Having seen death so often in World War II, he checked her, but saw there was no hope. 911 was called, and the jaws of life tore the car apart to get her out. This was an extremely deep loss for Desmond. A few days later, I took him to the funeral home and Chattanooga National Cemetery in my car because he did not have a car and did not want to drive. After making his selection of a gravesite for his bride, he sat in the back of my small car and wept for a long time. I waited until he was ready to go. At last, he paused and said, "At least she's not suffering, and she did not have to have surgery." Desmond found it almost torture to stay at home without Dorothy. He called me and asked if he might stay with us for a while. We gladly welcomed him, and after a few days tried to teach him how to make some of his favorite meals. He had never prepared his own meals, other than a snack, and it was hard to get him to think about fixing meals for himself. Even when Desmond was in a big crowd, he was still very lonely. After a few months, he began to consider remarriage, if he could find the right person. About 2 years after Dorothy's passing, he fell in love with Frances Duman. They were married July 1st, 1993. Now his new bride became his ears and wrote out conversations and sermons. This was not a burden for Frances. She enjoyed doing it for him. It was a great joy to watch them in love. At mealtime, they would always hold hands while giving thanks for the food, then kiss, then eat. In 1999, Desmond was diagnosed with bladder cancer. While in radiation treatment, he was weak and unable to keep food down. A lifelong passion for Desmond was supporting his church's version of Boy and Girl Scouts called Pathfinders. During his treatments, he was invited to the National Pathfinder Camporee at Oshkosh, Wisconsin. It often had 22,000 to 30,000 young people from 53 countries in attendance. He always enjoyed being with the young people, and they seemed to just adore him. At times, 200 to 400 youth would stand in line to talk with Desmond or get his autograph. The trip was almost canceled due to Desmond's health problems. But the Lord gave Desmond health for the trip. He had none of the normal symptoms of his radiation treatments.
This year, when Desmond stepped onto the stage, 22,000 Pathfinders gave him a long-standing ovation. Then he received the highest award possible in Pathfinding. They made him an honorary master guide. A master guide is required to pass a number of classes and read lots of books, etc. Because Desmond was a slow reader, he had never completed the coursework required. He was thrilled with this honor. Every time I witnessed Desmond's telling of his story of God's protection in battle, the crowd of perhaps 250 Pathfinders and parents were almost spellbound. Normally, kids that age would be wiggly and somewhat noisy, but not when Desmond was speaking. The crowd of kids was as quiet as mice under hypnosis. Through the years, many companies and individuals had tried to buy the rights to Desmond's story for a Hollywood movie. According to Desmond, they wanted to get the story and then make it into an exciting fiction thriller, like most films, to make a lot of money. This idea was very painful to Desmond. He said, "My story is not about me so much as it is about the God that I serve. When I was on the escarpment, after the first two or three men that I dragged on the ground to the edge, after the first few trips on the ground, I stood up while carrying men, with no attempt to avoid bullets. I figured if God had protected me on the first few, he might protect me for the rest. I just kept praying, 'Lord, help me get one more. And after that one, help me get one more,' until they were all down. In my mind, I felt I would be killed up on top. But I was at peace with that if that was God's will for me."
So he felt that somehow he needed to protect his story from fiction and from companies who just wanted to make money from it. In fact, the offers to buy his story would have been enough to make Desmond comfortable for the rest of his life. But in the end, he turned each offer down because the would-be producers were not willing to be totally honest with him or produce an accurate retelling of what God had done in his life. Perhaps some felt they could exploit this simple country boy, but he had a will of iron and would not compromise on his convictions. So, in 2000, all rights to his story, including movie rights and book rights, were given to the Georgia Cumberland Association of Seventh-day Adventists. The terms of his gift were that the association would preserve, protect, and manage Desmond's story, intellectual property, collections and memorabilia, and would use any proceeds to teach character development to young people and to honor God. In time, a Desmond T. Doss Council was established, and their first big project was to make a documentary of Desmond's story while he yet lived. Desmond, with Francis's assistance, attended as many of the production meetings as his health allowed, offering suggestions and approving content. The documentary was a huge success. Terry Benedict was the director, and the documentary received many awards at film festivals. The documentary proved popular with veterans. It has been shown on national television over a dozen times, and on Armed Forces Network and the Pentagon Channel several times. The distribution has been international. After the documentary, Desmond was willing, but cautious, about a movie of his experiences. As a final decision on a movie, he stipulated that the Doss Council could authorize a movie if it glorified God and would teach young people to trust in the Lord. In time, and initially, the story rights for a movie were assigned to Pandemonium Films and Walden Media. After nearly 11 years of patient waiting and on-again, off-again activity, a production entity was created, funded, and green-lighted. Actual filming began in Australia in the fall of 2015, with Bill Mechanic producing, Mel Gibson directing, and Andrew Garfield playing the role of Desmond Doss. Part of the treatment to conquer Desmond's tuberculosis was to remove his left lung. This left him short of breath much of the time. He had a slight build and only weighed perhaps 145 or 150 pounds most of his life. In his later years, he would ride the riding lawnmower from the house to his shed 300 feet away. His yard was large, and because of his shortness of breath and his failing eyesight, it became too much for him to keep up. So the decision was made to move next to Francis's son, Mike Duman, in Piedmont, Alabama. There were boxes of pictures, newspaper articles, and other mementos, all of which needed to be preserved somehow. In the preparation for moving, a small room was kept for memorabilia of all kinds. These collections entrusted to the Desmond Doss Council were collated and are housed in the Archival Heritage Room of the Del E. Webb Memorial Library, Loma Linda University, California. The collection contains pictures of Desmond Doss Sr. with 6 United States presidents and a host of important and precious people from around the world. Desmond's health gradually deteriorated until his death on March 23rd, 2006. He was 87 years old. His grave is close to the Medal of Honor tree near the top of the hill in the Chattanooga National Cemetery, Tennessee. One of Desmond Doss's favorite scripture quotes, "Trust in the Lord with all thine heart, and lean not on thine own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge him, and he shall direct thy paths." Proverbs 3:5-6. Les Speer is a Georgia Cumberland Association trust officer and was Desmond Doss's pastor for several years.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.